On today's episode, with precious few moves over the past 2 days, we'll look back at the first quarter of the baseball season and those transactions that shaped the first 2 months of baseball. The Red Sox made a big, big move that's worked nicely, and a small move that's messed up their hot corner production. The Brewers and the Yankees made all the right moves, the Royals are falling apart, and we'll even pick on Daniel Hudson, Brett Cecil, and Mike Napoli. It's the DFA Podcast. Welcome to Episode 9 of DFA, a podcast from Baseball Prospectus. I'm Brian Grossnick of BP, and we have the band back together today. Joining me, my co-host RJ Anderson. RJ, how did it feel to run this thing without me when you had your show with Meg earlier this week?
I think we can just move on, Brian.
It really wasn't that bad. I don't know why you would, you'd be down about it. I thought you guys had a good show from what little I listened to of it.
What a backhanded compliment. My goodness. Just fire me at this point.
Never, never. Sean, did RJ hold up okay?
I think he did fine. I think he's good in that role. I don't know why he's so upset about it.
You let your cat drive cars. I don't trust your judgment. Here's the thing, Brody. Like, I know that cat doesn't have a license. I don't think that cat's on your insurance. Go get him his permit before you let him drive.
You gotta be sure he's underage.
Oh, gosh, yes.
So, RJ, do you remember how you used to roast me and make fun of me because I always lost my debit card and cards and stuff?
I do.
Again, a week ago, my entire wallet got stuff back yesterday. I was going to tweet at you, actually, and let you know that I got all my stuff back. But, yeah, like the fourth time in 2 years, maybe?
Good grief, Brody.
That is
Let's just move on to the show at this point.
Right on.
It's coming from this conversation.
Well, it's funny that you say that, that there's nothing good coming from this conversation because, you know, in the limited time between our shows, there's nothing good that's come from the transaction wire at all. We've got nothing to talk about today in terms of actual moves that teams are making. But we'll hit the tiny minor things that have happened in the past 2 days later on in the show. So instead, we'll do things a little bit differently. Our big move for today will be not a move that's been made recently in the last couple of days, but instead we'll go ahead and we'll take a look at the first quarter of the season. It's been about 45 games for most teams, at least at this point. And we'll take a look at some of the off-season transactions that have kind of shaped how the season's going up to this point. And we'll keep Sean in the loop here. We'll just kind of go around in a circle. We'll start talking about the bigger moves from the offseason and how those have affected the season up to this point. So I guess the one I'd like to start with is probably the biggest move of the offseason. It's turned out pretty well, I would say, for both teams in this regard. And that's the White Sox dealing Chris Sale to the Red Sox. That was definitely the most, I guess, sexy move of the offseason. It was the, you know, all-star Cy Young caliber starting pitcher going from a rebuilding team to a team that was looking to be, you know, one of the top teams in the American League. Some consider the number one prospect in baseball. The BP list was a little bit lower on Yoan Moncada. He's going to Chicago, and he's been playing in the minor leagues up to this point. And then a couple of other prospects went to Chicago as well, Michael Kopech. This was a huge deal. And since coming over to the Red Sox, Chris Sale has been, what, the best pitcher in baseball? Probably more effective even than Clayton Kershaw. And so it's hard to judge this deal as anything other than a success, even though the Red Sox aren't necessarily atop the American League East. So, RJ, looking at the initial returns, what do you think about the Sale deal? The Red Sox made the right move, obviously, right?
Yeah. I mean, they're trying to win now. And, you know, Moncada has his skeptics out there. And I think we tend to view these top prospects as not bulletproof, but, you know, pretty close to infallible. And in Moncada's case, you know, maybe those concerns are valid and maybe he just turns into what, Javier Baez, something like that, which is, you know, a fine player, but it's not this, you know, era-defining superstar we were sort of expecting a few years back. And, you know, they've got an era-defining superstar in Chris Sale. You just look at his numbers. I mean, he entered today, which is Thursday for those who might be listening on another day with a 1.87 ERA plus and a 7.21 strikeout to walk ratio. And both of those would be single season career highs for a pitcher who's been in the top five in Cy Young voting like each of the last four seasons. And in addition to that, I mean, he just pitched on Wednesday night, and that was the first time he hadn't struck out 10 batters since his first start. So he's been very good. He's went fewer than seven innings just one time, and otherwise he's been the front of the rotation ace they needed. And we're talking about a Red Sox team. You know, we've talked about how they aren't necessarily performing up to snuff. However, where would they be without Sale? You know, David Price being injured, and I mean, even Stephen Wright being injured too. They, in hindsight, that they really did need someone like Sale, because if they didn't have him, where would they be right now? Probably not anywhere good. You know, Rick Porcello hasn't been quite as effective as last season, and Drew Pomeranz has been the Drew Pomeranz of old, it seems, albeit with a very nice strikeout rate. So I don't think they're regretting that trade, and I don't think they should regret that trade. What do you think?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, just from a statistical standpoint, he's got the highest strikeout per nine rate of his career. He's got the lowest walk per nine rate of his career, the lowest home run per nine rate of his career, which is, you know, kind of crazy going to Fenway. And then he's got, you know, of course, a pretty shiny 2.34 ERA, but hit Baseball Prospectus's deserved run average stat puts him at 1.27, meaning that statistically they feel like he's gotten a little unlucky, and he should have an ERA that's, you know, closer to Bob Gibson levels. And he's already got 3.4 wins above replacement player by BP's metric, which puts him on pace for a 10-win season over the course of the year, which is, well, first of all, on pace for is a little crazy, but, I mean, that's nuts. Pitchers don't really have 10-win seasons, especially by BP's metrics, very often. That's a season for the ages kind of run that he's having so far. You imagine that's going to kind of regress a little bit, because there's no great reason why he's so much better. You know, yes, he's getting the benefit of a lot better catcher framing, and I think that makes a difference for him. But, I mean, he's just been exceptional, and there's no way you can argue around it. And it's not like this is out of nowhere either. It's not like the Red Sox gave up these top-end pitching talents for a guy that was perhaps a number two starter, perhaps a number three starter. They went after a guy who was supposed to be an ace, and he's acting like an ace, so we should give them all the credit in the world. Moncada's hitting all right in Charlotte. I mean, he's not performing poorly in AAA. I think he's got around a 300 true average in Charlotte, which is definitely a good sign. I just, you know, when you have the opportunity to go get a pitcher like Chris Sale, you got to go do it.
Yeah. And I mean, if they are going to make the playoffs, he's going to be a big reason why, because he's helped keep them in position right now, even with the lineup not really hitting for much power, and even with David Price not being there and some of the other struggles in their rotation. So he's been a big part of their success, and he's going to continue to be a big part of their success, however much success they enjoy this season.
So you recall last year when he was pitching with the White Sox, saying that he wanted to pitch specifically to contact, that he felt he was throwing too many pitches and wanted to save himself going towards the end of the year. Coming over to the Red Sox, his contact rate is 67.4. Last year it was 76.7. So for someone to just turn it on and off like that and have the success we're seeing him have is just remarkable.
Yeah, that's a good point. You usually hear about, oh, guy's trying to pitch to contact more, or he's trying to miss more bats. That's a pretty stark difference between the two. That's just like you said, that's pretty impressive that he can just decide, oh, I don't want to pitch to contact anymore, I want to get strikeouts, and then successfully, you know, axe on it.
He has the best back foot slider in baseball. So
the changeup too, he went from throwing at 27.7% in 2015 to 15.7% last year to now back to 25.7%. So really, he just started to throw that changeup as an out pitch again.
So does this affect the Don Cooper as brilliant pitching guru narrative? You know, because it seems like the White Sox and this pitch to contact philosophy that they tried to engage on him last year was actually harming him, or at least in terms of performance.
No, I think Cooper has enough of a, I mean, you know, with Don Cooper, he has, what, a decade plus now of successful reclamation projects and whatnot. I think he's fine, even with Chris Sale. I mean, Chris Sale was really good there, so it's not like he was hampering him to the point where, you know, Chris Sale wasn't a consistent Cy Young candidate. This is just 10 very, very, very good starts, and we'll see what the rest of the season has, but I wouldn't be dinging Cooper too much at this point.
And the other thing about that is Cooper, part of his story is that he manages to keep his starting pitchers healthy, and we don't know if that'll continue if Sale moves away and you know, is throwing more breaking pitches. That may be something that might affect his health in the future. Hopefully not, but you know, you got to wait and see.
Yes. So we talked about the biggest move of the offseason being the Red Sox acquiring Chris Sale, but I'm going to shift gears to a pair of re-signings that were pretty big, and I'm talking about the Dodgers re-signing Kenley Jansen and Justin Turner. They ranked number 3 and number 5 on your top 50, Brian, and if you look at their performance this season, Turner's obviously on the disabled list right now, but he's hitting 379, 453, 493 in his first 162 plate appearances. That's good for a 155 OPS plus, which is the best on the Dodgers save for Chris Taylor, and that's not a statement I ever expected to make. And Kenley Jansen has been phenomenal in 18 innings. He's allowed 13 hits, 4 runs, 1 home run, 0 walks, and 33 strikeouts. He has a 276 ERA plus, a 0.09 FIP. So the Dodgers made the right decision retaining these two, right?
Yeah, I mean, it looks that way. These are big contracts to guys that, you know, there is some risk there. I mean, first, Jansen's a reliever, so there's always some risk. And Justin Turner, you know, he is on the disabled list now. He does consistently have these minor injury issues that he's kind of propped up against. But yeah, I mean, the Dodgers have the money to be able to go out and get players to fill needs, being a large market team, and they know these players well, so they went out, they got them, and they kept them, I should say, and I think it's working out very well for them. The other thing about these moves is that it's not like these are moves that would block up and coming talent on this team. Even though these are longer term contracts, it's not like the Dodgers had a great in-house third base option, or, you know, even if they do have great in-house relief options, you always need another reliever. So it's not like they were putting big money into bringing in, you know, Edwin Encarnacion and then blocking Cody Bellinger or something like that for the future. So I think this was a smart decision on the short term, for sure, and then we'll see if they'll be able to absorb and work around these contracts once the performance obviously starts petering out. But I mean, this is exactly what you would do, I would think, if you're the Dodgers.
Yeah, and we should note that Jansen has been clearly the best of the three big free agent closers. You know, both Chapman and Melancon are on the disabled list. So not only has he been excellent, he's also healthy, which is, you know, kind of an important attribute to have if you're going to contribute positively on the field. So it looks like the Dodgers made the right decision there with which free agent closer to sign.
We talk about third base a lot because there are so many good third basemen. How often do we forget about Justin Turner?
Very often, but I think it's because of the injuries thing and because he's a late bloomer. I think we have a natural distrust of late bloomers. I mean, it took Jose Bautista a little while to be accepted as well. It took Ben Zobrist a little while. So if you're a late bloomer, I think there's going to be a natural skepticism and a natural tendency to be overlooked.
Yeah, I think that definitely makes a big difference. And, you know, we're not just talking about a late bloomer. We're also talking about a guy who didn't have any prospect hype coming in. He was freely available multiple times, you know, a lot like Bautista. I think that's a good comparison. And, you know, he's a former Met and a former Oriole, and, you know, former Mets, you know, you expect them to be bad, and former Orioles, you know that they're bad. So I think that makes a big difference. And I think with Turner too, he still hasn't, even when he started to break out, it wasn't because he was hitting 50 homers in a season like Bautista was. He added power, but he gets a lot of his value through his doubles, his increased power, his ability to get on base. And when you talk about other third basemen, I mean, Machado and Arenado and Donaldson are transcendent talents. They are incredible talents, and Arenado and Machado are going to show up because they're also going to be putting up web gems, and Donaldson was an MVP. So, you know, some of these guys, it's more just the greatness of some of these other players, I think, as opposed to anything about Justin Turner himself, even at that point.
That's fair. And just to your point about Turner not hitting 50 home runs, he has played in 425 games with the Dodgers, so more than two seasons, and he has 51 home runs as a member of the Dodgers. But he has hit 305 with a 373 on-base percentage and a 492 slugging percentage, so he's been very good. Just hasn't been quite as good as Jose Bautista during his prime, which is, you know, there's a big gap there. So he's pretty good. He does deserve his recognition. And I guess it is a little weird that he's playing in a big market, albeit out west, and not quite getting the recognition that he seemingly deserves. So,
and then just two small statistical items on Kenley Jansen. His current walk rate is zero still. He still has not walked anybody this year, which is amazing. He only walked 11 people last year, which is also equally amazing, but still zero for this year is nuts. And his current FIP on Baseball Prospectus is 0.16. So he is looking to break that statistic. Good luck to him.
So moving forward, I guess to mine, it's a move that wasn't huge when it happened, but I know it got a lot of conversation. That was Eric Thames signing with the Milwaukee Brewers. It's $16 million for 3 years with one option tagged to it. But he has lit the world on fire since coming over. I know he's been worse of late, but batting .302 with a .433 on-base percentage and .647 slugging percentage, he's doing exactly what he did in Korea. And it's amazing that it's translated, and no one thought it was going to translate when he came over. He has just been amazing for the Brewers.
Yeah, and the scouting reports on Thames this winter were that he basically would profile as a nice platoon piece because, you know, there were questions about his approach, questions about his bat speed. You know, your typical fare for someone trying to make the transition from Korea or even Japan to Major League Baseball. And, yeah, I mean, he got off to that ridiculous start, and he's reached base 43.3% of the time still. And, you know, for a while there, he was like, you know, basically Barry Bonds. And it really has looked like a great value deal for them. Because remember, he signed for 3 years and $16 million. Like, that's nothing nowadays. If he were a free agent right now, he would get probably more than $16 million a season, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think you got to give the Brewers front office a lot of credit for being aggressive with this deal. They very much could have just signed him to a one-year deal, you know, kind of hedged their bets a little bit. I bet they would have been able to get him on a one-year deal, given what we knew about him going into the season. And to go for the three-year thing, to cut ties with Chris Carter and really commit to him, I think that was a pretty gutsy move. And like you've said, I mean, it's worked out better than anybody could have imagined. The guy's top 10 in baseball in walk percentage, which is just absolutely unbelievable compared to what he was before he went to Korea. I just don't think you can say enough good things about Thames and how he's started his season, right?
Yeah, and I would note that, you know, there was a lot of rushback about the decision to non-tender Carter and bring in Thames, because when you were just looking at, you know, it seemed like Thames' best-case scenario was sort of like Chris Carter. You know, last season, Carter hit 222 with 41 home runs, 113 OPS plus. So it was a little puzzling that they would non-tender Carter and bring in Thames when Carter felt safer, I guess, because he had done it in the big leagues for a few years now, whereas Thames' previous big league exposure, again, left him looking more like a platoon piece than anything. So, yeah, it was a gutsy decision on the Brewers' part, and credit to them. You know, whatever they saw or whatever they thought they saw, and I'm going to be honest, I don't think they saw this. I think they saw
– No.
Right. I think they saw maybe a little better than everyone else was thinking, but I don't really think they saw this. But it's, you know, hey, to the victor goes the spoils, right? And right now – they've had a lot of spoils to enjoy. So,
for a first place Brewers team, they would not be here had it not been for Eric Thames. I mean, they've hit well this year. They have the third best slugging percentage in baseball, which, if you ask me who 2 months in was going to have a top three slugging percentage, nowhere near that conversation would the Milwaukee Brewers have been for me. But it's just, it's a combination of Thames doing well and really they made some smaller moves that I think we're going to talk about later, but
oh, we're not going to talk about them later. We're going to talk about them right now. That's because that's the one of those small moves is what I wanted to talk about when we go into this round of talks, and that's the Brewers trading for Travis Shaw from the Red Sox. I mean, that's been a huge deal for them, and it ties directly into what you're saying about slugging percentage, because Shaw all of a sudden is proving to be a really legitimate power threat for this Brewers team. And the deal was to receive Shaw, who wasn't even the primary target in this trade, I don't believe. I think Mauricio Dubon, the shortstop in who's playing in AAA for the Brewers was, or AA, he's actually in AA now, was kind of the primary piece in this deal, it seemed like, where the Red Sox got back Tyler Thornburg. And Thornburg hasn't done anything for the Red Sox, and Shaw is now a middle-of-the-order hitter for the Brewers.
Yeah, and I agree with you. Shaw just seemed like a throw-in, like a, you know, hey, we have a opening at third base, let's grab him, let's see what he can do, because, you know, Boston's not going to use him. And I would throw in another small acquisition of theirs who is slugging, and that's Jet Bandy. You know, I don't think anyone really thought much of the Martin Maldonado Jet Bandy swap, but Bandy's hitting .275 with a .495 slugging right now, 5 home runs in his first 91 at bats. That's pretty impressive. And it's funny because I had a front office friend tell me Bandy's going to hit more than anyone expects. And I thought he was just joking around because, you know, it's Jet Bandy. But he looks like he knew something that I didn't. And it goes with, you know, the Brewers had similar moves last offseason, you know, with Jonathan Villar. And I believe they had one other. I'm blanking on it right now. But I even like their Nick Franklin pickup, you know, basically getting him for nothing. I know he hasn't performed, but at least it seems like David Stearns is pretty good at these smaller moves. And, I mean, you can look at their bullpen, too, with Carlos Torres. Who thought Carlos Torres would have been this good for them?
Not anyone who watched the Mets, I guarantee you that.
Right, and I also like the Jared Hughes pickup because I've been a Jared Hughes sucker for a few years. Like, I know he doesn't look pretty on the stat sheet, and I know he hasn't been as good as he usually is so far, but I like that pickup, too. So, yeah, I would say David Stearns seems to have pretty good ability to find, I don't know if I'd say undervalued players, but players who maybe aren't going to get ample opportunity with their current or previous organization. Also, we got to throw Eric Sogard in there because, you know, every former Athletics utility man is the official utility man of the podcast. Sogard's hitting .440, .588, .800 in his first 34 plate appearances. That's inspiring a lot of thirst, I'll tell you that. So it's been very good. And Hernan Perez has also been a nice little pickup for them. So,
and when you talk about the pre-2016 moves, I think it'd be remiss to not talk about Keon Broxton, who they picked up for a song and has been not as good as maybe Jeff Sullivan would have liked, but has been playing pretty well actually this year.
Yeah, and I like that deal for the Brewers at the time. I really didn't understand for Pittsburgh. I would also throw Jesus Aguilar in here, or Jesus Aguilar, excuse me. He has a 130 OPS plus. But yeah, Broxton's interesting. And I mean, even Domingo Santana, is sort of interesting in a way. So there are a lot of interesting players on this Brewers roster. And I'm curious to see what they're going to do closer to the trade deadline, because I could still see them moving a starting pitcher. And maybe I'm wrong there. I don't think they're going to continue to be this good. But I think they might surprise and, you know, move a starting pitcher and still try to post a decent record while still building for the future.
RJ, you got me there. I was going to bring up Eric Sogard. I think the most amazing Sogard fact to me is 34 plate appearances, has not struck out once.
He's walked 8 times, though.
Just incredible. And you also talk about Jesus Aguilar, .288, .342, .562 line, which is crazy for a guy they picked up off of waivers from the Indians for $500,000.
Yeah.
It's a great signing, just like you said. I remember doing a game earlier this year for BP Mets, doing a recap of a Matt Harvey start, watching Jet Bandy hit, and I was like, who is this guy? He's got a very pretty swing. He looks like he's going to be very good. Is he just someone who's having a good day today, or is this how he's playing the season? And, yeah, looking at his line now, that's a guy that I would like to see a little bit more, because he looks like he's got something to him.
The Aguilar thing is interesting to me because obviously when the Brewers picked him up from the Indians, I was like, hey, this doesn't even rate a transaction analysis, because I did a lot of research on Aguilar before the 2016 season as part of the development for the Indians chapter in the BP annual. And I didn't find anything in Aguilar's profile from my perspective that said he would be anything other than a pretty good triple A first baseman. So, you know, again, this is why the Brewers front office is special, and I am not.
Aguilar had one of the best annual comments in the book, I think. I don't know if y'all remember it. I'm going to pull it up right now.
So another thing we haven't really brought up, Matt Garza's revitalization has kind of come through, and I'm not the biggest Matt Garza fan, but he's got a 3.6 ERA. It's better than what he's done in the past, and if they do turn into sellers rather than buyers, he's a guy you'd have to think they're gonna move quickly, even though he got roughed up pretty heavily by the Blue Jays.
Yeah, I think he's just gonna regress. I don't buy this continuing. His walk rate has been just unbelievably good, and I don't think that's gonna keep up. And he's not showing anything in terms of his stuff that makes you think like, oh, this is gonna be like there's been a dramatic uptick from last season. So I'm not real confident in that. He's never been a guy who's walked this few batters. So, I mean, if he can keep it up, great. I just don't see it happening. And he's only made 6 starts this season. And like you said, the last one wasn't very good. So I wouldn't be surprised if all of a sudden the wheels kind of come off.
6 starts, 6 home runs surrendered, and 6 walks given up. So
yeah.
Matt Garza.
That's weird.
This page does not seem to be wanting to load for me, but it was something like, you know, being a right-handed first baseman nearing your age 27 season or whatever is the equivalent of being a spinster in a Jane Austen novel or something. So,
all right, here we go.
It just I've loaded now. Okay, nope. Brian, you do it. You have the voice for this. I don't. Do it.
I'm 27 years old. I've no money and no prospects. I'm already a burden. That's Charlotte and Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, but maybe also Jesus Aguilar if you swap money for money tool. Being a quad A first baseman nearing your 27th birthday isn't really so different from being an unmarried woman of the same age in 19th century England.
That's so good.
Oh my
it's really
Lord.
Good.
Emma Bachelet wrote that, and that was really good. She had some very good comments in general, so not too surprising, right?
No, not at all.
So if we're talking about smaller moves now, I want to highlight a few kind of in rapid succession here. I would start with Ivan Nova. I don't think anyone really knew what to make of him after his very good stretch with Pittsburgh last year. You know, it was 11 starts. There was a track record of him being frustrating, sort of a tease. Pittsburgh took a chance on him, signing him to a 3-year deal worth $26 million. He's been very good in the sense that he's not really allowing walks, not really allowing home runs. The thing is, you know, he has a 2.63 ERA, a 3.28 FIP according to BP. Of course, DRA is over 5, which would actually be the worst he's had since 2012 in terms of a full season's worth. So that's an interesting one. And I mean, Pittsburgh's not regretting signing Nova. I guess I would just ask, you know, which metrics do you buy more on him? Do you buy the DRA there, or do you buy the ERA and FIP?
That's a tough one. Generally speaking, I try to lean towards DRA because I know how it's developed, and I think that the contextual factors that are taken into account in DRA are very good. However, in a smaller sample, I usually like to lean more towards FIP just because I know it's only based on the strikeouts, the walks, and the home runs, and those are kind of easier for me to pick out individually. The big thing for Nova that I think is like a going concern for him is his walk rate is so incredibly low right now. And I think he does benefit from a little bit of, very good framing on the Pirates. And I think that's probably going to assist his walk rate a little bit. He's also a ground ball guy, which kind of sometimes that doesn't show up in DRA and FIP and any of these pitching metrics. I just have a feeling he's really pitching it more of like a 3.7 ERA true talent right now. And so I'd really like to see, because the underlying metrics are not that different from his previous season in Pittsburgh last year. The walks are really low. He didn't walk anybody, but his strikeouts are down. So I would expect him to be a little bit worse than he was in his time with Pittsburgh last year, not what's really a little bit better is what it looks like from those stats.
I think Brian hit the nail on the head. He's more of a 3.7 ERA guy than a 2.6 ERA guy, but time will tell, I guess.
All right, so I want to move on to another small move that I think has paid dividends. Excuse me. And Brian, you weren't here last episode. You were too busy in Ethiopia. So Sean, this is going to sound familiar to you, but shifting to the Angels, big bad Buddy Norris has turned into seemingly a legitimate ninth inning option. Through 22 appearances this season, he has 9 saves. He has a strikeout per nine rate of 11.8, a 3.44 strikeout to walk ratio. He has allowed 5.3 hits per nine, and he has given up one home run. So are we buying Bud Norris as the relief find of the offseason, or at least one of the relief finds of the offseason, or is this just a case of small samples playing tricks with our minds?
I mean, I really want to say it's a small sample issue. The one thing that makes me think maybe something has changed, because his velocity really hasn't changed, but with the exception of his cutter is back to around the velocity that it was in, I believe it was, 2013, 2014. And I think that makes a little bit of a difference, because his four-seamer is basically the same pitch it was. His slider, his sinker, they all seem to be coming in at the same velocity. But that cutter is back and useful again. I don't know. I think that he's probably not as good as he has been because he's Bud Norris. But I definitely think that there has been a little bit of an improvement over what he's been the last couple of years. So, maybe he's not going to be continue to be a lights out closer, but I mean, he's okay in a leverage situation now.
Yeah. And I'm just surprised it took this long for someone to really devote him to the bullpen. I know there was that stint with San Diego and I believe it was 2015. And, if you looked at his numbers then, he had a huge ERA. But if you looked at the peripherals, they were actually pretty close to what he's doing now with a slightly higher hit rate. Then he went to Atlanta. And I know he spent time in the bullpen with Atlanta and with the Dodgers, but it seems like, everybody keeps trying him in the rotation. And I get it because, he's been okay. He's not been great. He's been below average for his career, I believe. But, it's hard to find 5 serviceable starting pitchers. So I get it, but it's surprising me that it took this long for him to be turned into a full-fledged reliever, because I always thought that was the role he would have done best in. His command was never really there, and you talked about the stuff profile. I don't know. I don't think he's this good either, but I think it's probably pretty likely that he is a better reliever than starter, which I guess is true of everyone, but I'm thinking better reliever than we anticipated him being as well.
So, Brian, you talked about how he's thrown his cutter a lot harder than he has in the last couple seasons. He's also thrown it a lot more than he has. His usage rate is 37.47. Last year it was 11.49. It's really being taken from a mixture of his four-seam fastball and his slider. My question is, though, do we think he's just throwing his slider a little harder? Because cutters and sliders are that weird pitch where they're almost eerily similar to each other. Do we think he's just throwing his slider harder?
Oh, I thought I recalled seeing that he actually had started to throw a true cutter, and this wasn't just the slider, but I could be mistaken on that.
Yeah, I honestly don't know enough to be able to differentiate, unfortunately, so I can't really help too much with that. But he has in the past had a lot of pitches categorized as sliders versus cutters, and so it's kind of gone both ways in the past. I'm not at all a pitch shape expert, so it's really tough for me to be able to speak to that. The one thing that I'll throw out here is the cutter does appear to be getting lots of ground balls, and it kind of always has for him. But the thing right now is he's given up maybe 5 hits per nine, which is completely out of line with anything. Like, that's way fewer hits per nine than he normally should be allowing. He should be allowing something closer to 7 or 8 or 9 hits per nine just by virtue of being a normal pitcher. So that'll probably bring his BABIP up as time goes on, and I think that'll maybe do a little bit of stat regression for him.
All right, so I have 2 other teams that made a combination of big and small moves I wanted to touch on. Let's start with the Yankees. I think we're all a little surprised by their success this season, but during the winter, they made the decision to sign Matt Holliday. That has looked very good. They made the decision to re-add Adam Warren. That has looked very good. You know, they signed Chris Carter and definitely give a logic there. We talked about him, I believe, on what, the first or second episode, and he hasn't really performed up to snuff, but they also formed the roster where Aaron Judge could stay up, and we all know that has worked out very well. So I guess I'll open up here, like, which team set of moves have you liked the most in addition to the Yankees?
That's a tough one.
It doesn't have to be big moves. It doesn't have to be big moves.
My short answer of combination of moves would probably be the Astros. And that's mainly on the strength of Brian McCann and Charlie Morton, adding those two to the team. Because the other moves that they've made, you know, Josh Reddick has been good. But Nori Aoki and Carlos Beltran have been bad. So those moves, I think, as a whole, make the team look very good. They've got a lot of depth now. But then again, they also cut loose Robbie Grossman at one point, and that's looked like a kind of a disaster too. So I think that's helped them out a lot. I mean, you can look at almost any of the teams that are playing well right now, and you can say, oh yeah, they made good moves in the kind of the aggregate. I don't know, Sean, what do you think?
I think it would go back to who we were talking about earlier, the Milwaukee Brewers. If there was a team that did any better than the Yankees have done this year, because I think it's just, it's in a completely different spectrum where the Brewers made these small moves to kind of stay afloat, keep going. The Yankees made these moves to keep their young guys up, and they're showing that there's some benefit in that. Like, Aaron Judge has been just tearing the cover off the ball this year. And Matt Holliday looks like it was a great signing. It looks like, I remember seeing something, I believe it was on MLB Network a couple weeks ago, that Holliday loves being in the DH role because he can sit on the bench and he can watch pitchers and he can really dissect somebody on the mound, and he doesn't have to worry about going out into the field. So I think if they had realized that in signing him, that is just a very smart move by a general manager. And you don't know if they did that, but still, it's working. He's batting .275 with a .370 OBP and a .500 slugging percentage. So it's small things like that that they're not going to be long-term for them, but they do help them in the long term because it keeps those young guys up.
I was just going to say about the Holliday thing real quick. I find that interesting that he likes the DH, because with Pat Burrell and some of the other, mostly National League lifers who transition to the DH role later in their career, they kind of get bored, or, you know, they kind of are prone to falling into these prolonged slumps because they think too much about hitting and there's no fielding opportunities to break up that monotony. So that's interesting that Holliday actually embraces the role.
That's literally what I was going to say, which is funny because we kept trying to say the same thing. Like, his one season that he had in Oakland, I understand Holliday was not very fond of his time in Oakland, and I wondered very much that if going to the American League would be something he was kind of opposed to in general. So that's a really great point, RJ.
Yeah, and I want to bring up one more signing that, I don't know, at the time I felt like it didn't get ton of credit, but Matt Wieters, he's been much better than I think we anticipated. You know, his .261 true average right now is better than would have been last two seasons, albeit barely over 2015. Of course, that was just, you know, a shorter season, but yeah, he's done well, and the Nationals definitely needed an extra piece of depth, you know, especially knowing now that Adam Eaton's out for the season. So it's another little signing that I liked at the time, and I like more now given the team complexion.
I have two minor moves real quick. Both are first basemen. Both are left-handed. One in the AL, one in the NL. The first I'm going to start with, Mitch Moreland. He has been really good this year for the Red Sox. .266, .361, .462 slash. Did anybody see him doing this well coming over?
No.
Yeah, I don't know, because this doesn't actually. I don't think Moreland's doing as well as we think he is. This is the exact same line that he kind of put up in, from a true average perspective, that he did in 2015 in Texas. He's hitting above average, and that's good. And his OBP is obviously up to .361, which is very good. But this isn't like wildly out of line with what his normal production is. It was substantially worse than this last year, but this is kind of what I more or less expected, and it's also not that valuable for a first baseman. this is, you know, it's good. You always want to have a first baseman who's able to hit above league average, but he's not a great defensive first baseman. The Red Sox just brought up Sam Travis to get some more reps at the DH and first base position. So I think that this is, it's definitely a good move. It's not like the team got worse by adding Moreland, but I don't see this as really making a big difference, and I don't think he's a long-term fit.
Way to kill Brody's dreams there. What was your ever move, Brody?
Can I rip that one, too?
Jeez.
Yeah, all right, let's go Adam Lind. the Adam Lind signing, I think we talked about it a little bit with Meg last week, but he's been very good. I think he was injured for a little portion, but again, he's 333, 392, 622 line. Granted, it's only been in 51 plate appearances, but he's been part of this Washington National offense that has been just amazing for this first 2 months of the year.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because there's sort of shades of the Matt Holliday conversation we just had there. You know, Lynn has been a consistent most days player throughout his career. I know he's had injuries, but if you just look at his playing time, like, he's not used to sitting on the bench all that often. And for him to embrace this, I mean, he's basically a designated pinch hitter for them. You know, he's not going to be playing over Ryan Zimmerman too often. Doesn't really have a, you know, another position he can fall back on. So his job is to come off the bench in the sixth or seventh or eighth or ninth inning and get his one plate appearance a night. And, you know, to that point, he's appeared in 27 games and he has 51 plate appearances. So he's not even getting two plate appearances per game. But yeah, he's been very good, and I believe he's either tied or set the Nationals career franchise record in pinch hit home runs already, and he's been there a month and, what, three quarters? So he has been a very good value signing for them. And I was surprised that a team like the Rays or whomever didn't sign him as a maybe a plan B at DH/first base, you know, especially as a platoon option, because it wasn't too long ago. He was a very very good and underrated hitter against right-handed pitching. I mean, he had a stretch there, I think it was from 2013 through 2015, where he was consistently posting OPS pluses around the 130 mark. And, you know, Seattle, you know, we need Meg back here to describe how poorly his Seattle stint went, but very good signing on the Nationals part, very smart one, very savvy one, it looks like. We'll see if that one, if it continues to pay dividends. But remember, they have a mutual option for next season. So if he continues to play well in a limited role, I'd be curious if they would bring him back or if they would be able to trade him for something, you know, perhaps a reliever, not a high leverage reliever, just like a middle reliever, come the winter. So that is a good one.
Yeah, I love this move going into the offseason, because even though he was so bad with the Mariners, I thought he was a really kind of savvy backup plan for Ryan Zimmerman, who had looked terrible before this season. And when you have this kind of depth, which the Nationals hadn't always had before, when you have the positive event of Zimmerman actually being very, very good this year, this is a pretty vicious bench weapon.
It's a lot like Matt Joyce was last year for the Pirates, right? I mean, come off the bench, hit a home run, go back to the bench.
Right.
That's the life right there, Brody.
The Matt Joyce life.
That's the equivalent of a cat's life as a ball player. You know, get up, eat, get petted, go back to sleep. And you know, Joyce, he really has not built on that this year. He's back to being disappointing. That's sad, because at one point he was like my favorite hitter. You know, he had the command of the strike zone. He had power against right-handed hitters. Excuse me, right-handed pitchers. If he had power against right-handed hitters, that'd be way more impressive. But it's just sad. And he's older than you think, too. So maybe this is the actual beginning of the end. And last year was just the dead cat bounce to tie it all back to felines. So
that was. Very, very nice work trying to tie all that cat stuff together, RJ. I'm very, very impressed. Can we talk a little bit about the moves that haven't worked out real briefly before we move on from this topic? Because there are a couple of guys. You know, you mentioned before that I made a list of the top 50 free agents before the season, and that's an incredibly humbling experience to look at now and say, like, wow, I was so wrong about so many of these players. I really don't feel like I did that bad, but you still managed to be wrong about so much. The guy who I think I might have been most wrong about might have been Daniel Hudson. I had him as maybe the fifth best reliever on the open market last year. That was a mistake. He has not been good. I had him right behind Brad Ziegler as one of the best prospects for a relief pitcher. He pitched well in Arizona, and Arizona's rough territory to be pitching well in relief for. But he went to the Pirates, which should have been a strong benefit to him, and he has been not good at all this season. His strikeout rate is the same, but he's lost any ability to get ground balls. His command has regressed a little bit, and it's been pretty ugly. He's got a 6.38 ERA right now, and his DRA isn't that much better. But the Pirates are still leaning on him. I mean, he's pitched quite a bit. He's already made 22 appearances this year. There's a chance it'll regress a little bit because his hits per nine is way higher than it should be. He's giving up 12 hits per nine innings, which is it seems like it would be unsustainable. He's got a 4.18 BABIP, but still it doesn't look like he's going to turn out to be the kind of high leverage reliever I thought he might.
Yeah, I remember putting him on a list with Jorge De La Rosa and John Jay as players I felt were going to be bargains because, Hudson, like you said, last season his surface level numbers were poor, but he has good stuff, a good fastball, a very good changeup, and he was pitching in front of the worst defense or one of the worst defenses in baseball in a hitter's park. So him going to Pittsburgh seemed like a slam dunk for improvement and like value. And yeah, he's been worse even than last season so far. So that's really a huge disappointment.
Do you want to talk about Mark Trumbo for a minute? Because that was one of those moves where I feel like going into the offseason, people were saying, oh boy, this guy's going to get a big contract and he's not going to live up to the hype. And isn't that exactly what's kind of happened at this point?
Yeah, I don't think he got as big of a contract as people were expecting when they said that, though. Like, if you would have went back to any point last season, like, say, last September and said, would you sign Mark Trumbo for 3 years and $37.5 million? I feel like most people would have been like, yes, but he's not going to get that. He's going to get closer to $50 million or whatever because he's coming off a huge home run season, over 100 RBIs. You know, I feel like that's – I don't know. Maybe I'm underestimating the way people thought of his earning potential, but he's been – not as good as they would have hoped for, obviously. And it's kind of interesting because, Baltimore has seemingly been so good at finding these bargain deals, including Trumbo. Mm-hmm. And you look at their roster and, they have seemingly – I mean, I guess it's unfair to be like, if they would have let Trumbo walk, they would have been perfectly okay because Trey Mancini, he's been very good and albeit in limited action, but – it's kind of funny to think maybe if the Orioles were let Trumbo walk, we'd be talking about how they found a suitable replacement right on their back porch, so to speak, in Mancini. So, yeah, I guess that deal was a disappointment. Trumbo, that is, has a 95 OPS plus, so maybe he'll get going and top the century mark. But, yeah, I definitely get your point there.
Yeah, and with Trumbo, I do think the one other thing is, you expect him to be the home run guy. You expect him to be the guy who's hit a ton of home runs. He's just had six to this point in the season. So
yeah, they're not paying him to hit singles.
No, and to his credit, he's not. So that's that's going about as well as everybody had planned.
Can we have Brody with us? Here we go.
So
thank you for joining us.
I was debating between two, and the one is a move that has kind of surprised me because the Cardinals' double magic didn't really work out, and that's Brett Cecil. You know, 5.4 ERA on the year. He's a guy who pitched very well in the bullpen for the last, four seasons since 2013. He was moved to the bullpen by the Toronto Blue Jays, but since coming over to the Cardinals, he has not been anything spectacular.
Yeah, he's walking the world, and he's giving up a lot of home runs, and that's always a bad combination, especially out of a high-leverage reliever, because, we look at these things in sort of a vacuum. We don't really consider the situational value here, but, you walk a batter or two, and you give up a home run, and you're a high-leverage reliever, well, there goes the game, Mm-hmm. So we don't quite consider – I mean, I know there are metrics out there that consider the context, but usually we're not looking at those metrics when we're evaluating players in terms of predictive value. So he's actually been worse than his raw numbers suggest because of the timing of these walks and home runs. So, yeah, he's been a big disappointment.
I really like shutdowns and meltdowns as reliever stats, which are, you know, how much they affect. If you affect a team's win percentage by more than 5%, you get a shutdown. Or if you affect a team's winning percentage by, you know, negatively to 5%, then you get a meltdown. And Cecil's had 6 shutdowns to 9 meltdowns this season, which is wild. You're absolutely right about the context for him today.
Yeah, and I think we should mention Jason Castro in here as well, because he signed 3 years, $24.5 million. You kind of knew coming in that a lot of his value would be on the defensive side of things, especially particularly with framing and staff handling. But, you know, he's already, I mean, so far he's hitting 200, 317, 343, 17 walks and 123 plate appearances. But, like, I don't know. I was skeptical about paying market value for framing to begin with, and I'm still skeptical about it because – this is not really, you know, that's not really a batting line you want to see in the first year of a $20+ million contract. And I understand he's adding on the defensive end, but this would be the second worst offensive season of his career since his rookie season if this line maintains. And I mean, that's, I don't know. I just don't, I don't think I'm conditioned to like this deal. And I don't think I'm conditioned to think that this is going to work out as well as Minnesota thought it would, even if I'll grant that he's having probably a positive effect on their pitching staff and allowing them to overperform a bit. But I think that's a disappointment for me so far.
One thing I'll throw out real quickly there with that one is that how much that pitching staff is outperforming their peripherals is remarkable. Irvin Santana.
Huge.
Yeah, the defense, and I do think Castro has an effect on that. I think as a game caller, he's probably head and shoulders above everyone the Twins have run out there since the Joe Mauer years.
Fair. I buy that.
So I got one more disappointing move for you, and we're going to stay in Texas for this one. It's Mike Napoli signing. He has been horrendous this season. 198, 267, 432 line. It's the only point in his career that he has had a negative warp. And when he came into Texas, I don't know about y'all, but personally, I thought he was going to do well because he's always hit well in Texas. Granted, that's not great reasoning for that, but he had a 318 true average in 2015 for his short stint with Texas. In 2011, he had a 353. In 2012, he had a 287 true average. He was a lot younger then than he is now. But he has just been bad for $8.5 million, and he has an option for next year. Do we think it's going to be picked up, or do we think he's going to start playing well again?
I was skeptical about him because I don't think he was as good last season as the fan hype suggested. Like, the party at Napoli stuff, I think, kind of overshadowed that he wasn't actually, like, having an amazing season even by his standards. So I would anticipate him hitting the free agent market again this winter.
Just throwing this out there, he's been terrible against right-handed pitching this season, and he has faced almost only right-handed pitching, which is kind of a weird choice, I think, that the Rangers are making. They're running him out there against everybody, and he hasn't faced a lot of lefties, and he's a lefty guy. He's a guy who may be more of a platoon player at this point. So as a right-handed hitter, having him face 123 plate appearances or 136 plate appearances against righties versus 45 against lefties is going to hurt him in the way that he's being deployed too, because he is unable to draw a walk against right-handed pitching. He can't do it.
Yeah.
When Beltre comes back, you'd have to think that he's a candidate to platoon with Joey Gallo maybe. Gallo hits well against right-handed pitching, or hits well against right-handed pitching relative to left-handed pitching. Napoli's not terrible against lefty pitching this year, but yeah, I completely agree with that. He's really being hurt by hitting against righties.
It's interesting because the reporting today says that Gallo is going to move to left field once Beltre comes back. So,
oh,
interesting, right?
That is certainly a position that they could put him on.
I want to throw out one more disappointment: Jason Hamill. I thought that he would be – I mean, I basically thought it was going to be one of two things. Either he was going to be a disaster or he was going to be a typical Jason Hamill and look like a steal. He's been a disaster. His strikeout-to-walk ratio is down to 2. He's allowing the same amount of home runs as last year, but with more hits, more walks. His strikeout rate is down. you know, he's 1-6 with a 5.98 ERA, and he's averaging just over 5 innings per start. So, you know, maybe everyone who passed on him knew exactly what they were doing. And whether that has to deal with medical issues or what have you, it looks like a smart decision by on the part of everyone else to forego giving him that 2 or 3 year contract. And I know he wound up with a 2 year contract, but I believe there were reports that he wanted a 3 year deal. So sorry, Jason Hamill. It looks like I was wrong about you.
Yeah, I don't think there's much to add about that. I mean, everything has kind of gone wrong for the Royals, but I think you're right on target with that one. He just has not performed the way anybody, I think, anticipated. So we can't end on that note. That would be just too sad. So let's go over the few minor moves that have happened in between the Megan RJ show and our show today. Sean, hit us with these minor moves. What few ones have been made in Major League Baseball up to this point?
So we have a couple for you. Andrew Applin changing hands and going to the Seattle Mariners from the Houston Astros. What do we think he's going to do this year?
Not much. Brian, you missed this rant last time out, but the Angels had brought up Nolan Fontana, and he was a former Astros farmhand who leaned on his on-base skills to make up for his lack of a hit tool or power. And guess what Andrew Applin is? He's a former Astros farmhand who leans on his on-base skills to make up for his absence of average and power. Last season, he had a miserable season, which, hey, that was just like Fontana. I guess I'll just run this out again. The comparison I made last time is whenever there's a hitter with a skill set, are they going to be Brett Gardner or are they going to be Sam Fold? Andrew Applin is going to be Sam Fold. He's just not going to be able to hit big league pitching, I don't think. This season in AAA, he's hitting 250, 375, 345. That's really not going to translate well to the majors in all likelihood. So, he's okay, I guess, if he's your fifth or sixth outfield option. You certainly don't want to be starting him. You probably don't want to be using him in platoon role. So that's way more than anyone cared to hear about Andrew Applin.
Yeah, he's a weird guy in that I consider myself pretty well-read in terms of baseball, pretty well up to speed on rosters and prospects and things like that. I had no idea who Andrew Applin was before I saw this move made. He is not a guy who projects to do almost anything. He, just like you said, his skill set doesn't seem like one that would translate particularly well to the major leagues. However, he does show up on Fangraph's Cato prospect projection for this year. He was the top 100th player in that projection system for future performance. So somebody somewhere thinks that he can be productive. I wonder if maybe Jerry DePoto is reading Fangraphs and looking at Chris Mitchell's prospect projections and saying, well, there's a chance he could be good and we don't have to give up anything for him, so let's give it a shot. But I'd be shocked if something like this worked out for them anything more than, hey, we need an emergency sixth outfielder, let's give it a run.
So we have another one for you now. Luis Sardinas changing hands, going from the Padres to the Baltimore Orioles. So I have a question for you. He has 4 home runs at this point in his career. If he comes up and plays a major league game with the Orioles, it'll be his 5th team. What does he end up with more, teams played for or home runs?
I want to say teams played for, because he's a 24-year-old who, in theory, can play shortstop. He's going to have at least another 5 years, maybe longer, I think. I know he doesn't perform well in the majors, but, you know, these kinds of guys, they can seemingly hang around forever. So, yeah, I'm going to say he's going to finish with more teams played for.
The thing about Sardinas is that he lost his job as the Padres shortstop this season when the Padres signed Eric Ibar as a minor league free agent. It's not a great sign. Ibar is a fine player, but the Padres weren't obviously committed to using him very much if they were willing to shuffle him off that quickly. He wound up with, 53 plate appearances for the team this year. He didn't hit. He didn't hit, and he definitely did not hit. I will say this. He did get to pitch again this year, same as he did last year. So that gives him now a career ERA of 0 in 2 innings of work and a career FIP of 3.09. So Hey,
height doesn't measure heart. Height doesn't
the
measure
Orioles heart. Can always use more pitching. Also, J.J. Hardy's terrible, so maybe he'll.
I love the last second breaking like the Kool Aid man. J.J. Hardy's terrible. I'm back out. So I get two more for you. Josh Colminter DFA'd by the Braves, and Matt Weisler back on the Major League roster. So is Weisler going to do anything this time?
Now, the most interesting thing here is that Josh Colminter kind of looks like Mark Norman. And otherwise, I got nothing interesting to say here about these moves.
I'm just so shocked that Colminter had such a rapid fall from grace. He was like for a hot minute, he was the Diamondbacks, big time starter in 2014. He had a good run. He was deceptive. Colminter this year actually had a really high strikeout rate for the Braves. It just so happened that he also gave up all the home runs, and that won't help. He had a huge home run for fly ball rate, but he had given up almost four home runs per nine innings. But there's no real hope that Colminter is going to recover. And Whistler, I looked a lot into Whistler over the last couple of years, and I just don't have any faith that he's going to be anything other than an up and down kind of a garbage long man spot starter type guy at this point in his career, because even in AAA, he's not striking anybody out. He tends to give up a lot of hard contact, and he's just not been effective at all. He had a long run of time last year for the Braves and was bad. And then in four games in relief this year, he's been very bad. So bad.
So I guess Josh Colminter, maybe he's striking out that many, because if you tire out the other team by giving up all the home runs, that might help you.
Excellent point.
He's got 3.71 home run per nine, 3.18 walk per nine. So
more home runs than walks. Not a great sign.
It is very, very fun for him. But moving on to one last pitcher, Nathan Carnes to the disabled list. And he has been kind of good this year. I think he struggled last season, but really has done well this year relative to then. Can the Royals survive it?
No.
Nope.
I mean, they aren't surviving to begin with him, so they're not going to survive without him. It's disappointing for me because I used to really like Nathan Carnes. I like the body. I like the fastball-curveball combination. I like the strides he had made with his changeup, but it doesn't seem like he can stay healthy. And I wonder how many more opportunities he's going to get before someone puts him in the bullpen and he becomes a pretty good eighth inning reliever. Because, I mean, he turns 30 in November. I don't think we realize how old he is. And he's had a history of injury problems, even dating back to his minor league days. So, yeah, and his career high in innings is not even 150 yet, and he's going to be 30 soon. So my guess is he's heading for a bullpen perhaps as soon as next spring, perhaps as soon as, this summer / fall, depending on what the Royals want to do there. But it's just disappointing because he could have been a number three, number four starter, and it just doesn't look like his body is going to allow him to do that.
Yeah, it's disappointing to me. You mentioned that he's not particularly young, but he doesn't have a lot of service time. And I think the Royals coming into this season, they had made a couple of moves like adding Jorge Soler and adding Carnes that were kind of more medium-term decisions rather than win now. They wanted guys who could be effective now but also effective in the future. And it seems like basically those moves went backwards on them. It seems like a lot of their young players that they were expecting to be effective this year, whether it's Soler, whether it's Raul Mondesi in limited action, Paulo Orlando, some of these guys who are more likely to be with the team past next year, even looking at guys like Alex Gordon, have completely collapsed. And this is just kind of another example for it. It's one of those like signs that to me that the Royals are headed for another period of really, really terrible Royals baseball after this kind of really nice positive period, because I don't know how. If Carnes really is a bullpen piece, if Jorge Soler is really just like a fifth outfielder, there's not much for them to build off of going forward.
Just another manic Monday in Kansas City, Brian.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, my.
With that, we will call it an episode. Thank you so much for listening. You can find out all about the DFA podcast on iTunes, where we'd love for you to give us a rating and even a review if the mood strikes you. You can find us on Twitter at DFA Podcast. You can find us on Baseball Prospectus all the time. You can find RJ at CBS Sports.
Watch the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah. Right. And beyond that plug, you can find Sean at BP Mets. You can find him at Beyond the Box Score. You can find him at Sabre Seminar this year. Am I correct in saying you'll be helping to present with a couple of partners?
Yes. Jen MacRamos and RJ Sokash, we are going to be presenting a thing at 8 in the morning on one of the days at Sabre Seminar this year. And really excited about that. We've worked on it for a little bit, and hopefully it comes together, and we get to present something really cool, because I think our idea is really cool, and yeah, it's looking forward to it.
Well, congratulations. That'll be fun to look forward to. RJ, are you going to be able to make it out to Sabre Seminar this year?
Probably not, but Brody, just don't lose your presentation.
Yeah.
I do like to think that that Sean does his best work with an RJ in tow, so that should bode well for your presentation as well.
His name is Sokash, so you know he's money.
Oh man, yes. The puns are flying now. It is late in the show.
Hey, you weren't here yesterday, or not yesterday. You weren't here the other day. It was pun city.
Oh man, now I'm really glad I missed it. So you can check out Sean at Sabre Seminar. It does look like I'll actually be presenting at Sabre Seminar too, so everybody should go and see Sean and myself present about different baseball topics and say hi. And again, you can find the show on Twitter, on Baseball Prospectus. Oh, and we are now on Stitcher. So I want to make sure to let everybody know that you can find this podcast on Stitcher as well at this point. I believe we've also got a Facebook site now, so you can find that on Facebook, if you want to use Facebook, which I don't think any of us do. So that's it. That'll be our show for today. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.